Welcome to The Market, sponsored by the CME Group. Hello again. Along with Max Armstrong, I'm Orion Samuelson with our weekly look at markets from Wall Street to the soybean fields. Somebody called in and said there's more than wheat, so you're covering that market as well as the other markets. And so, yes, indeed, we are doing that. And Max will be talking markets a little bit later with his guest this week, Clayton Pope of Clayton Pope Commodities in Chicago. And we're not without news beyond the marketplace this week because of all that's going on the geopolitical scene. First of all, Canada, the G7, and then coming up later in the month of September, just a few days away, the meeting in Singapore. So how did we end the trading week on our first five-day week after the Memorial Day weekend? Well, let's take a look. The stock market closed higher. Investors apparently shrugging off concerns about the global trade tensions. However, trading volume relatively light ahead of a busy week of central bank meetings. The S&P 500 stayed in positive territory in the afternoon after reversing losses in the early part of the afternoon, with its biggest boosts coming from the healthcare and consumer staples sectors. And investors appeared to put aside worries about U.S. relations with its biggest trading partners. G7 major nations started what was expected to be a tense meeting after President Trump's decision to impose tariffs on steel and aluminum imports from Canada, the European, and Mexico. And expectations for any breakthroughs at the two-day meeting in Quebec, Canada, were low. For example, one analyst said it's highly unlikely there will be a final communique, and that, according to a G7 official, he didn't want to be recognized, however. But some investors appeared hesitant ahead of the U.S. and European central bank meetings. And then, of course, there's the North Korea-U.S. summit set for June 12. Carol Schleif of Abbott Downing in Minneapolis said, "There really is a lot for investors to digest, but when you go through the noise, there's still a lot of strength in the economy, and that's what investors keep gravitating to." Specifically, investors were focused on expectations for strong growth among U.S. corporations. Another analyst said expectations for sales growth of more than 7% this year. And Wall Street estimates 2018 earnings growth of 22%. That's according to Thomson Reuters. And so the analyst said the math looks good in terms of the relation between price and earnings and sales. It's a perfectly good time to be long in the market. So for the day, the Dow Industrial Average gained 75 points to 25,316. The S&P 500 gained a little over 8 points to end the week at 2779. And the NASDAQ Composite added 10 points for the day, ending at 76.45. And for the week, the S&P up 1 2/3%, while the Dow added 2 3/4%, and the NASDAQ gained 1 1/4%. The Consumer Staples Index, the biggest percentage gainer of the S&P's 11 major sectors, with a 1 1/3% advance. Biggest drivers there, Procter & Gamble, which continued its rally from the previous day, rising 1.9%. Philip Morris, which rose 2.6% after it announced a 6.5% dividend increase. And then Monster Beverage, another staples company, up 4 3/4% after the energy drink maker said it was highly likely it would raise prices later in the year. And then, of course, there's the healthcare industry. All the time I have spent at the Mayo Clinic in Arizona the past year tells me if you're looking for a career, look into the healthcare industry. Not only are the costs high, but I'm finding that salaries are pretty good too. And after one more visit and visiting with the technical people, it continues to impress me on the cost of as much as a chair or a hospital bed. So that's probably, if you're a young person looking for a career, healthcare right now looks like it would be pretty good. In the quietest trading day since May 25th, 6 billion shares changed hands today. That's compared to the last 20-day average of $6.6 billion for the 20 days. U.S. investors also keeping an eye on Europe, as the European Central Bank's chief economist has said policymakers meeting on June 14th will debate whether to end bond purchases this year. And then there is the unprecedented meeting between the president and North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un, scheduled for June 12th in Singapore. So there's enough going on inside the business world and outside the business world to keep traders on edge this week. Let's take a look at what's ahead this week in some of the other areas. We, of course, are watching the meeting on June 12th in Singapore. And then the Federal Open Market Committee will begin a two-day meeting on Tuesday. And the Fed is widely expected to raise the interest rates by 25 basis points when it announces its decision on Wednesday. The Fed, of course, held interest rates steady in its previous meeting and expressed confidence that a recent rise in inflation to near the central bank's target would be sustained. But it just isn't on this side of the Atlantic that we're looking at conditions, because on Thursday, the European Central Bank will meet and announce its interest rate decision. That will be followed by a news conference with the European Central Bank President Mario Draghi. Policy likely to remain on hold, but the governing council will start discussing whether to end bond purchases after September, preparing for a decision in July. The bank also expected to raise its inflation forecast, but cut growth projections. Now, let's take a look at what's on the economic calendar for the U.S. this week. The Labor Department will release its Consumer Price Index report on Tuesday, and they're not looking for any surprises in that one. On Wednesday, the Producer Price Index for May is forecast to show a 0.3% increase. Retail sales, import prices, and jobless claims data scheduled to be released on Thursday. And then, of course, for the week ended June 9th, we get initial claims for state unemployment benefits, expected to remain steady at 222,000. The U.S. Senate Banking Committee will vote on the nominations of Richard Clarida to be Federal Reserve Vice Chairman and Michelle Bowman to be a member of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors. Both had a relatively smooth confirmation hearing, and their nominations are expected to advance to the full Senate for approval. And then as the second quarter comes to a close, top executives of Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, J.P. Morgan Chase, and other banks are to give assessments of their businesses at an investor conference in New York on Tuesday. That will be hosted by analysts from Morgan Stanley. And on Friday of this coming week, Dallas Fed President Robert Kaplan will speak at a business leaders luncheon hosted by the Fort Worth, Texas Chamber of Commerce. So plenty outside of all of the geopolitical activity going on, and will all be on the minds of traders this week. But there'll certainly be a lot of attention focused on Quebec, and Singapore. Oil prices. Well, prices fell today. Concerns about surging U.S. output and falling demand in China weighed on the contract, and J.P. Morgan cut its price forecast. Brent crude futures settled down 86 cents at $76.46 a barrel, and U.S. crude futures ended down 21 cents today, $65.74 a barrel. In the past 3 weeks, oil prices have declined from 3-year highs, and the market has contended with supply concerns. Today, oil prices came under pressure after data suggested the Chinese demand was waning and concerns lingered about the growing oil output in the United States. So another situation to take a look at, because all of industry and agriculture here in the United States indeed consumes a lot of petroleum product. Also this week, job openings rose to a record high in April, but hiring continued to lag, pointing to a worsening shortage of workers. Job openings, a measure of labor demand, increased to a seasonally adjusted 6.7 million. That's up from 6 million in March, and the highest level since the government started tracking the series back in December of 2000. And I've been spending about 4 weeks or so in Phoenix and Scottsdale, Arizona. Construction would move a lot faster if they could get workers. A lot of home building going on, but a definite shortage of workers in that industry. So, one other note, the value of Apple could climb well past $1 trillion. Been a long time coming, but Apple could soon be worth $1 trillion and counting. At $943 billion at the start of this week, the tech giant close to being the first company to pass that threshold in market capitalization. And so what's big is getting bigger, certainly in the technology area that we have watched just grow tremendously over the relatively short period of time. Well, it's time to talk agriculture and market activity there and how the trade problems affect agriculture. And we'll do that when we continue with Max Armstrong and his guests here on The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
The ever-interesting grain market scene gets a little more interesting this time of year in many years. Clayton Pope Commodities, joining us in the studio this weekend. Now, I, of course, should note the fact that it wasn't very interesting for producers in many of the past few days, as we've seen corn and soybean market erosion. Is that solely based on crop bulletins, crop progress, crop conditions?
Well, there's always so many factors at play, Max, as you know, but I think a big part of the problem right now is the funds really kind of got ahead of themselves, just buying the heck out of the corn and bean markets, reached net long positions that were huge from historical perspective, and maybe jumped the gun a little bit. You know, it's still pretty early in the crop development process, and it's just kind of like you have to feed the bull, and it kind of ran out of food for a while, let alone a little bit of negative news, you know, via weather and some trade concerns. So I think you're seeing them bleed a little bit.
But condition ratings have been pretty good.
Absolutely. They've been excellent, to the surprise of a lot of people, I think. Certainly a lot of the producers we talk to are feeling better and better about their crops, but the uniform feeling I get from people is that as good as these conditions look right now, the word I keep hearing is fragile. The subsoil moisture is pretty low. It wouldn't take a whole lot more heat without moisture, you know, to kind of, you know, put the brakes on these crop improvements, I'd think. But we are, you know, expected to get some rain here in the next week or so, and I think that's absolutely critical that we do.
Let the record show that when condition ratings are high as the season starts, they tend to fall. Not always, as we saw in recent years, but they
right.
almost always go down.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we're starting at such a high point here. I mean, it's certainly, I would guess, best case scenario as far as crop development, you know, versus condition ratings is, you know, sideways in the ratings. It'd be almost impossible for them to rise from this level at this time of year.
We do, as we look at the drought monitor, see some interesting spots to watch. And I pointed out simply because I looked at one of Tom Skilling's weather maps this week for the moisture in the week ahead. He was looking, and this was on the Tribune page, as I recall, at some fairly good moisture amounts over much of the Corn Belt. But a notable exception was Missouri that was going to be left out. They're pretty doggone dry already, aren't they?
They really are. The northeast part of Missouri, for sure, which would be, you know, their main production area, in that southern small part of Iowa as well, and even west central Illinois up around that area it has some extremely dry areas. So you know how it is. It's going to be so frustrating for those poor producers in those areas to keep reading all these headlines about the amazing rains, the amazing crop conditions, and they're like, what the heck? Every wet forecast I get fails to materialize. You know, when's it going to change? But welcome to farming, I guess.
We have some of those growers sitting very close to us here in the Chicago area where we're recording this broadcast, because I know when that Alberto moisture came through the other day, there were some growers, for example, along the Illinois-Indiana state line around Kankakee County and over into Newton County, Indiana, in that area, who missed much of that moisture. They didn't
Absolutely.
Get much out of it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And they need it now.
Oh, they need it very badly. And in Indiana, even, they were hurting real bad. As a matter of fact, there was a story just yesterday in some of the Indianapolis papers talking about its extreme dry conditions there. But Alberta did give them a very helpful boost. They hit about an inch and a quarter in some of the driest areas there. But, you know, these kind of 95-degree temps, an inch of rain is only going to last so long.
So this moisture that is in the forecast, as we look to the week ahead, is really, really critical from the market standpoint, isn't it?
It is critical, and it seems like there's some pretty good uniformity amongst the forecasters that it's going to happen, but who knows? You know. But another thing I want to say, though, is when you read the Twitter sphere and talk to a lot of people and so forth, you get the feeling that a lot of the trade or followers think that 4th of July pollination is it. You know, if it's cool and rainy during that week, then this crop is absolutely made. And believe me, I'm not saying that it's not important. It's absolutely hugely important. But even then, I mean, the rest of the summer does matter, even to the corn crop.
Well, and then the soybean market, I mean, we can throw a lot at it right now.
Right.
And still wind up with remarkable yields, can't we?
Oh, absolutely. It's almost what happens right now is irrelevant for the bean crop, it seems like to me.
We have a World Ag Supply Demand Report coming up fairly soon. What's your feeling about what it might show? This one, isn't this the one that can really, really jar the market? Haven't we seen that historically
at
times?
Yeah, we have. I think the July one might be more so, just because we'll have that June acreage update in between. On June 29th, I think, is when that is. But, yeah, even this report, I think, is important, not so much from the U.S. as the world production numbers. I think we're almost certain to see a reduction in Argentine and Brazilian corn production numbers. And the world carryover in corn is already at, 4 or 5 year low or something like that. You take another 3.5 million metric tons off that, and it's going to get a little bit snugger, which makes the ongoing and relentless weakness in corn a little bit of a head scratcher, if you ask me.
If that report turns out, let's say it turns out to be bearish. Let's say there isn't the reduction mm-hmm. in the supplies that the trade is expecting.
You mean the USDA could surprise us?
How long-lived would that report be in the market? In other words, regardless of how bearish it is, mm-hmm. could the impact be soft simply because it's so much about U.S. weather right now?
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point, actually, because the whole market process is a discounting mechanism, and it's been chewing on these private South American production estimates for a long time. And in typical fashion, the USDA tends to be a little behind the curve in terms of foreign production updates. And you get the whole host of private people and, you know, not only South American firms but or government agencies and U.S. Firms all throwing their numbers out there and so forth. But with very few exceptions, they're almost the whole street is lower than the USDA's numbers. But and so absolutely right. A lot of that is baked into the market at this point, I'd say. So let's just say they came out unchanged, which would be bearish, I would think. That would, brother, be the last thing in the world this corn market needs, right. That's for sure. So it would just take that much more of a severe turn in the weather to really give the bulls some hope here.
From the standpoint of the producer who's looking at this and thinking, doggone it, we missed an opportunity maybe the other day. What kind of guidance do you offer? Do you think there's another good shot here somewhere for marketing corn?
Yeah. Again, dealing with or looking at corn specifically, I'm not giving up. And maybe I'm I don't want to be naive and, you know, you don't want to be married to your position or whatever. But when you look at the market right now, I mean, amazingly, our price of Dease corn right now, 401, 402, is almost literally exactly what it was a year ago. And our carryover is 23% less. It's like 500 million bushels less than what the current crop year's carryover was a year ago. So you look at that, there really is next to no risk premium in these prices right now. Add to that the fact, I think the USDA started with too high of a yield. I mean, they're assuming 174 for national yield. That's the third highest yield ever, you know, largely because of the last 2 years have been phenomenal. And I think they're underestimating demand. I mean, like I just said, whether they change the South American corn production numbers or not on Tuesday, they're already significantly lower than the early in the year forecasts were. As such, I was absolutely shocked when USDA came out with their first new crop U.S. Corn supply and demand, they lowered exports by 125 million, and they raised beans by 225 million. It just seems backwards to me to think that we'll export less corn next year than this year. I'll believe it when I see it. So I don't know. I think the demand side is encouraging, and the supply side is, on the world basis, is getting smaller. So I'm not really throwing the towel at all on this corn market.
And look at the calendar. It's early, isn't it?
It is
early in the
season. Yep.
Clayton, thank you for the visit. We appreciate it. Clayton Pope. In the studio this weekend.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
So as we take a further look at agriculture, let's take a look at some good news for the cattle industry, because it was reported this week that fed cattle in Kansas and Texas traded at $115 per hundredweight. That was up $5 from last week. So we start with that good news for the cattle industry. It hasn't had that much good news recently, it seems like. And surging cash prices, easing trade fears, boosted CME hogs as well. Hog futures closed higher today, fueled by rising prices for market-ready hogs, and less concern about U.S. pork trade with Mexico and with the United States over pork, because pork is one of the big commodities that's been hit with tariffs retaliatory by Mexico. But that could have been mediated somewhat this week by some activity that the Mexican government said it would allow some U.S. pork into the country duty-free under an import quota, despite retaliatory measures taken this week after Washington hit Mexico with higher steel and aluminum tariffs. One trader said, "We move a lot of hams to Mexico, so this might offer some short-term relief." And wholesale pork values did go up today at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Meanwhile, as we look at the grain market today, there we find continued good growing weather, putting some downward pressure on the wheat and the soybean markets today. The July wheat contract ended the day down 3.5 cents at 520 a bushel, and the July soybean contract ended the day down 5 cents at $9.69¼ a bushel. Corn managed to close slightly higher, up 0.75 cents to $3.77¾ a bushel. But weather continues to be a concern. So far, we're off to a very good start in the U.S. crop year, despite the challenges we had early in the planting season. But we're still looking at good to excellent conditions in the corn crop at 78%. Pretty doggone good number. Now let me answer a question that I'm frequently asked by my listeners, and it has to do, again, with this agricultural export picture. How much of our U.S. farm exports are at risk in the trade disputes that we have? Well, more than $20 billion of $140 billion of U.S. farm exports has or is likely to have retaliatory tariffs against it as a result of the trade disputes with countries such as China and Mexico. Mexico put tariffs on American products ranging from steel to pork and bourbon, retaliating against those import duties. And President Donald Trump has also, or I should say China, has also imposed tariffs on U.S. pork and other products. But it's the export of pork that seems to be taking the biggest hit in this retaliation process, because the more than 14% of $140 billion in annual farm exports have been hit or will likely by the retaliatory tariffs on trade disputes. But it's interesting, when you look over the list of some of the products, I was fascinated by the Canadian list of products which they're taking retaliation measures. Maple syrup, and I didn't realize this, 70% of the world's maple syrup production comes out of the province of Quebec, Canada. And the U.S. does export maple syrup to Canada, basically from the state of Maine, but also from Vermont. And so Canada said, you're hurting some of our maple syrup producers, and so we're going to put maple syrup on that list. The other interesting item that I found on that list was toilet paper. Apparently, we import a lot of toilet paper from Canada, so they put that on the retaliation list as well. It's quite a game, really, that the countries are playing, and they're probably going to continue playing it for a while. Just like the game between corn producers and big oil here in the United States, that continues to be on the front burner as well, causing President Trump to put a hold on any changes in the Renewable Fuels Association policy. And both sides seem to welcome that move by the president, but where it'll go from here, who knows? It's amazing to me that gasoline companies, oil refiners, have to put ethanol into the gasoline tank, and they do that. They've done that for quite a while, but they're still saying the nasty things about ethanol that they have been saying for a long time, even though it's, what, 2 or 3 years ago that we went through the argument on how bad it was to take food and put it into our gas tanks. So that's pretty much the end of the story for this week. And this coming week, you know what we'll be doing. We'll be watching the various meetings that are taking place that will, of course, have an impact on industries in this country, on workers in this country, and also on agricultural products in this country. The one more note, we seem to be getting closer to self-driving vehicles in this country. Tesla shares up 3.5% this week after the chief executive Elon Musk said it was now churning out 500 of its Model 3 sedans a day and should achieve its 5,000 vehicles per week target by the end of this month. So that's continuing to move. Cadillac is going to put the technology in all of its Cadillacs beginning in a couple of years. So get ready for sitting with an empty driver's seat in your automobile. Thank you for joining us. That's our time. Along with Max Armstrong, I'm Orion Samuelson, saying thank you for joining us on The Market, sponsored by the CME Group.